afternoon.
Just throwing the water around there for you, Casey.
Thank you. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Vanita. It's my great pleasure to introduce Vanita and also to welcome my wife, Katrina, to our luncheon today. So Vanita is the CEO of Lupin Pharmaceuticals, and she went to pharmacy school to prepare her for the category. Lupin has subsidiaries in the United States because its home office is in India. She is indeed a pharmacist, MBA from Northwestern School of Management. The number of international recognition she's got may have me going overtime. But she has led Lupin through an extraordinary growth curve, both in acquisitions as well as inorganic growth. She has regularly been named by Forbes Asia in its top 50 business power women for Asia Pacific. She's been widely recognized for her leadership and vision, and she is therefore in the Business Hall of Fame Most Powerful Women in Business in Asia and the Pacific. She was named Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year, and she was a 2012 award winner for Health Services and Technology in Maryland. She is regarded as one of the most influential people in Indian business. In 2017, Vanita was appointed to the board of directors for Intrexion, and she currently is a member of the Global Advisory Business Board at the Kellogg School of Business. She was appointed vice chair of the Global International Global Business Association, which represents all pharmaceutical growth outside of the large pharmaceuticals, by and large, the generics. So with that distinguished career, Vanita is going to tell us a little bit about what represents 18% of our GDP.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you, Rick.
So, Vanita, I always like to start these little conversations by giving our guest the floor. So you can say anything you'd like to welcome the group, talk about the students, yours.
Well, first of all, happy St. Patrick's Day to all of you.
We both got the message, both green.
Well, this is not only in honor of St. Patrick's Day, it's also Lupin's color. So I love it. Thank you so much, Ed, Rick, and to the Forum Club for the opportunity to speak here. I'm truly honored and delighted. You know, our industry, the generic drug industry, creates such a significant impact, but it's like a well-kept secret. It is not broadly known. So I always love an opportunity to build awareness about our industry. So look forward to talking to you today about generics, what we do, the difference we make and are going to make in the future. But before that, I'd like to congratulate the four seniors, the students here that were terrific. It was wonderful to hear all four of you, you know, talk about your dreams, your plans. It's amazing to me how you already know what you want to do. I mean, geriatric oncology and anthropology, you know, biology, anthropology. It's amazing that you know it already. And, you know, the audience doesn't know. The students know that I have a son who's a senior at Community School of Naples, is a buddy. And I know what you've gone through in the last year. I have firsthand experienced both the pressures, the stress, as well as the excitement of starting this new chapter of life ahead of you. So I'm going to share what I've been telling him for the last 1 year, that this is just the start. I mean, you have a long, long journey ahead of you, and, you know, you certainly should take it seriously because it starts defining your future, but enjoy the journey along the way. I'm a strong believer of work hard, play hard. They go hand in hand. So So really enjoy this journey ahead of you. I'm looking forward to celebrating with you later in May. I will certainly be there at CSN for all the celebrations.
I'll bet your son is looking forward to celebrating with them with them also.
There he is. Yes.
So, Vanita, maybe we can start with the reason I did, excuse me, the Jeopardy question about the size of the pharma industry. So in the U.S., it's $380 billion. You know, it broadly breaks into a branded pharmaceutical and generics. Could you just tell us, what's the size of those? How do they fit together? Is there competition between them? Is it good to have both of them? Could you just help us understand that world?
Sure, sure. So the $380 billion, if you look at it from a revenue perspective, roughly 80%, 82% is brands, and 20% is generics. So around $70 billion is generics. Everything else is brands. And when you look at it from a prescription standpoint, you know, from a unit standpoint, the drugs that you see when you get products from the pharmacy, 91% of the market is generics. So 91% of the prescriptions is 18% of the drug spent. That just tells you the brand drugs are 50 times more expensive than generics. So that is the kind of benefit generic drugs bring to the to healthcare spend and drug spend. If I think about the savings the generics have contributed over the last many years, just, you know, last year the tally was $380 billion, you know, of savings through generics versus brands. And then you start looking at categories like cardiovasculars, $50 billion. You look at cancer, $17 billion worth of savings now that biosimilars, you know, generic biologics are on the market. So substantial impact that generics have created, substantial savings that generics and biosimilars bring to patients as well as payers and government. I'd say that in terms of there's an intricate relationship between brands and generics. Today's brand is tomorrow's generic. You need brand companies to spend research dollars on innovation, especially innovation around areas, diseases with unmet needs. And you need generic companies to come later in the day, you know, after the brand exclusivity has expired, to bring a cost-effective, affordable generic version to the market. So it's like a cycle. You know, today's brand is tomorrow's generic. So that, and we need both. We need the brand industry to bring drugs that meet unmet need, and we need the generic industry to ensure that you know, drugs are affordable and patients have access to affordable medicines.
So you mentioned, I'm struck by the statistics you had, the disproportionate share of generics as a percentage of scripts, but not of revenues. So is the U.S. the highest place in the world for drugs, for pharmaceutical? It's important because we all use them and we all have to pay for them. But is there a benefit, is there a plus and a minus to that? How do you think about it?
So the U.S. for brands is the highest priced market in the world. A brand drug in the U.S., when you compare it to India, when you compare it to Europe, you compare it to Japan, you compare it to Latin America, the U.S. is the highest priced brand market. For the generic, given the competition that one has in the generic industry, I find in some cases the prices are lower than India, which is considered the lowest priced market, as well as our neighbors, Canada as well as Mexico. So, you know, the pricing of drugs in the U.S., especially branded drugs, is high, but it's also because the U.S. really bears it, you know, the biggest burden of the innovation spend. If you look at the R&D spend, the pipeline spend for new drugs around the world, the U.S. contribution there is roughly 50%. Europe used to be, 5 years ago, was around 25%, is down to 20%. They've brought it down. China has grown up almost to, it's over 10% now, 12% innovation. But when you look at the entire globe and look at where majority of the drugs come from, it is from the U.S. The highest productivity in research dollars is seen in the U.S., and we benefit from it. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we pay a price for it, but look, I mean, you know, during the pandemic, which country worked at the same pace as us here in the U.S. in getting the vaccines, the mRNA vaccines approved by the FDA and getting it to all of us? Which country did it? With the right efficacy. I mean, people didn't trust the vaccine coming from China or Russia, you know. So it is a high-priced brand market, but it also bears the cost of innovation.
Do you think that if we bear the highest cost, do we get access to those drugs first? I mean, I'm never quite sure how that works, because you get into the whole regulatory environment. So you have the FDA and its processes, then you have the equivalent of the FDA in France or Germany or Japan or what have you. So if we're paying the highest prices, are we the ones that get access to it first? I don't think so. I think it depends.
For sure we do. Almost in every case I have seen, innovative drugs are available in the U.S. first. I mean, look at, you know, CAR T therapy right now, which is mm-hmm. a game changer mm-hmm. for cancer therapy, you know, cancer conditions. You look at Europe has less than 40% of the CAR T therapies that are available in the U.S. because the European regulators are not approving them. Low and middle income countries, Brazil, India, China, don't have them. Right. So we definitely get, we are the first to get the benefit of innovation. Mm-hmm.
So the other side of the U.S. getting the benefit of innovation is some of the third world countries get nothing. So if you think about Bill Gates and his foundation trying to bring, to increase the level of healthcare provided to third world countries, is there a special role for generics in that drive?
For sure. I mean, it's a wonderful role that generics already play in the low and middle income countries. And again, it's an area where brand companies and generic companies collaborate. For example, for HIV, and I think this is going to happen in other conditions as well, where generics can bring affordable versions to market. But for HIV drugs, brand companies, Gilead, will partner with companies like us for India or South Africa or Latin America so that we can bring affordable versions to the market. Mm-hmm. So generics play a big role in low- and middle-income countries.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that always confuses me is the how products get to market. So a drug manufacturer will make a product, but then it gets sold to a wholesaler or a pharmacy benefit manager, to a drugstore chain, to a mail-order chain. Is that process in the U.S. so different than what you see every place else? Are there pharmacy benefit managers anyplace else, and is that a margin that they enjoy, which doesn't exist in other areas?
You know, it's amazing. Pharmacy benefit managers don't exist anywhere else in the world. You take a look at all the PBMs, it's only in the U.S. where you have PBMs. And they take a disproportionate part of the value chain. I mean, it is a very, very inefficient system in the U.S., I'll say. I mean, the drug is prescribed by a physician. Payer needs to cover the drug, you know, for a mm-hmm. patient. A pharmacy benefit manager will get the payer a formulary that determines what drug can the payer pay for, and the pharmacy will dispense when you go to the pharmacy to get the drug. So it's a pretty convoluted...
There's a lot of hands in that pie.
Yeah, there are a lot of hands in that pie, and it really is the reason why the benefit of generics is not seen by patients. I mean, there are too many steps along the way, too many hands in it.
Does it ever change? You know, things that are in place are very difficult to undo, although disruptive technologies can do that. But does it ever change? I mean, does it get simplified so it goes from a prescription from a doctor to a deliverer and boom, it gets to a patient? Or is that just too wishful thinking?
I hope that happens. I mean, we from the generics industry standpoint would love to really find better ways of getting generics direct to patients. And when you see models like Mark Cuban's company, it's called Cost Plus Drug
right.
Company.
Right.
You see Amazon now getting into the distribution business, there's real hope. I mean, as more of folks like these come up with a direct-to-patient model, we are really creating competition for these vertically integrated large players like, you know, you look at Aetna, Optum, CVS. They're one. And they can, with the PBM and the insurer and the formulary as well as the pharmacy, they can determine exactly what they want to buy.
There's no escape. There's no escape.
Right. But Mark Cuban's company is starting to create an impact, and we hope Amazon creates an impact, and we hope there'll be more companies like this that will disrupt. And you have digital companies, Hims and Hers, Roe, you know, trying to go direct to patient. So we would like to see more of the market go to direct to patient so patients can benefit from the cost of the low cost of generic drugs. I mean, the PBMs are, the other option is the government should regulate what PBMs should make. I mean, in all of the countries, India, for example, we have a maximum retail price that we set, and the government sets a distributor's price, what the wholesaler can make in terms of markup. They set the pharmacist's, upcharge, the percentage the pharmacist can make. It's all set. For the value that they bring, this is what they get.
Mm-hmm.
So either you go to that model and you regulate PBMs
mm-hmm.
and insurers, or you go to a more streamlined system of getting more channels to get drugs direct to patients.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does Medicare and Medicaid fit into that? Because they are such large influencers, I think, on the price of the drug. So how would you put them in a simplified distribution chain?
Well, I mean, now with the Inflation Reduction Act, CMS has embarked on a journey to start negotiating products direct with manufacturers. So I think you are going to see some benefit of it. I mean, you are going to see, brand companies negotiate with the government on pricing, drug pricing for the future.
Well, then you can cut out that middleman. I mean, if the price is set, you can.
For sure. I mean, you'd want to make sure for the brand side you don't lose the advantage of innovation, because that's what I see as the major downside, the unintended consequence of the Inflation Reduction Act. I jokingly call it the Innovation Reduction Act, because
mm-hmm.
I've seen so many companies, brand companies, curtail the drug investment and try to really maximize, as opposed to maximizing a drug and looking at every indication it can treat, they don't have an incentive beyond a point to work on a drug.
Well, I think you raised a really good point before on COVID. If you look at the response of the U.S. pharma industry to COVID, I mean, it completely outshone the rest of the world. And that wasn't by accident. It's because for the last 15, 20, 25 years, those companies have been working on AIDS and SARS and other kinds of viruses. And there was a store of knowledge which didn't exist in the rest of the world. So if we lose that innovation, we may not wind up in a better place.
Absolutely.
We may wind up in a cheaper place, but not a better place.
Not the best options, treatment options, is what I'm concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the U.S. not only innovates directly, I mean, as we were talking about the pandemic period, when you look at the mRNA vaccine, I mean, the biggest one was European. You know, both of them were actually Moderna as well as
yes.
BioNTech,
yes.
European. But the Europeans did not leverage it, the U.S. did,
mm-hmm.
which is fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So do you think there's a lot of press around right now about the price of insulin? Where both Lilly and a few of the other maybe more generic manufacturers have responded to the urging of the government, and they've really dramatically lowered the price they charge for insulin. Whether it winds up being lower for the end user remains to be seen. But is that a model? Is that what you were referring to before, maybe a model of price regulation that works in the U.S.?
Yeah. I mean, for essential drugs, the government has been very strong and vocal about insulin pricing, and the companies have responded. And I think one can do more so. So as CMS starts negotiating with the industry, the top of the list is going to be essential drugs.
What do you think of the FDA? So I don't want to put you in a tough spot, but so many of the great institutions in the United States seem to be wounded, maybe is a fair word, you know, with the FBI and Justice Department and CDC and FDA. Do you think it still has credibility? Does it feel different to you now coming out of COVID than it did going into it?
Well, I will say we saw the best of the agency, best of the FDA during COVID. I mean, the kind of responsiveness that we experienced from the agency in the Project Warp Speed that the government created was unbelievable. That is what pushed the industry to really get vaccines as well as therapeutics as fast as possible to the market, to patients. I will tell you, we had our own success through COVID with one of our inhalation drugs. We make albuterol inhaler, mm-hmm. ProAir generic, and we're waiting for it for a long period of time because these complex products really get, they are a curveball for the agency. I'm sitting on one right now. I mean, this week has been a week of going back and forth with the agency on our first dry powder inhaler generic, Spiriva generic. We have filed it in 2018, so it's 5 years. And so, I mean, they are trying to work with the industry. They're coming up, they have come up with new mechanisms to work with the industry to facilitate and expedite safe and effective products to market. But through COVID, I mean, when I would, for ProAir, for example, there was a huge surge in demand for albuterol because, you know, asthma and COPD patients were at the highest risk through COVID. So you had to bring the product to market as soon as you could. So I went to the agency under the emergency use authorization, and they responded like this. It was amazing. So they can do it, mm-hmm. you know. I think the Congress is putting a lot of pressure on the agency to clear the backlog, to expedite, you know, the approval process. And I think they will get there. I mean, their first focus is safety, the safety of drugs for the patients, which is a common objective for the industry and the agency. But I think the pandemic really showed us that the agency can work hand in hand with the industry to ensure that the safe products get to patients in time.
You know, it's interesting. So you think about the FDA's challenge with respect to drugs that would treat Alzheimer's or forms of dementia. And you know, they got severely criticized for approving one that looked like it was helpful in the treatment of Alzheimer's. So they then pulled back and didn't approve other things. So it's a real balancing act for them. Are the scientists at the FDA up to that?
I think the FDA learns as well. I mean, we are learning through this dry powder inhaler. The FDA is asking us to do things to learn at our expense. You know, so they are learning. On Alzheimer's in particular, I would say it's a tough challenge, right? I mean, it's for the pharmaceutical industry, it's been one of the toughest right. challenges. And until the Biogen program that was controversial, there was nothing else. I mean, when you look at the older drug, the anticholinesterase inhibitors, they are marginal. You know, they really help symptoms, you know, reduce symptoms for 8 to 12 months. That's the best they do. So it is important for the agency to consider drugs that can be, you know, game-changing. And to me, I mean, the Biogen drug that came under a lot of scrutiny, I mean, it was the first amyloid antibody, you know, and then you have the second amyloid antibody, you have the Eisai product, Leqembi,
yes.
that got accelerated approval. Right. And when you see the results that drug had in terms of meeting the endpoints, both the primary and secondary, so reducing the amyloid plaques as well as the cognitive, you know, the improvement in the cognitive function, mm-hmm. it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
So there will always be some risks as we go through the process, but if you don't take risks, what do you get?
Well, and in the case of Alzheimer's, I mean, there is nothing else. There's nothing else. So either you're in a declining state, a severely declining state, or you try something that maybe you haven't fully proven, but it's almost like you ought to take a chance on it.
Absolutely.
Is the equivalent of the FDA when you get outside the U.S. equally good? I mean, would you consider launching a product to what we talked about before? Would you launch a product in Germany or the U.K.?
We do.
Before the U.S.?
We do. I mean, we have drugs that we launch only in U.K. and Germany, and there are drugs that we launch only in the U.S.
How do you make that decision? Is it you'll get quicker approval? It's more applicable to the population in those countries? How do you choose one versus the other?
So they're all different. The regulatory requirements in different countries are different. Europe now has a harmonized regulatory system.
Yes.
So they have the mutual recognition process, and UK has got its own system. The BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, all have their own systems, and you have to really demonstrate that the product meets their requirements, you know, to the local regulatory authorities. But I mean, now in the more complex products, so for example, biosimilars that are very onerous, you know, investments. For example, you know, compared to a tablet capsule that costs a couple of million dollars, our first biosimilar cost us $100 million.
Yes.
Enbrel biosimilar. And that was a global development where you took patients from the U.S., you took patients from Europe, you took patients from Japan and did a global trial and tried to get the agencies to agree. So we're still working with the agencies, the FDA, European authorities, as well as the other regulated and developed market agencies to come up with a more harmonized process for the more complex products so that it enables us to bring generic versions of these products to market sooner.
So before we turn the question and answers over to Rick Cash and get the questions from our audience, do you see a next big thing out there in the pharma space? Is there one, two, or three things that you have enough visibility on that you think it's really going to be big and change this industry?
I feel there's so many things, you know, that what we were talking about, this Alzheimer's treatment, you know, and the companies that have Alzheimer's drugs in development, that could be the next big thing. I hope Lilly's drug that's in development right now is going to be 60% efficacy versus, I think gene and, you know, cell therapy is really, you know, we as an industry believe that
it's a fascinating area of science.
It's a fascinating space.
It's just incredible.
It's a tremendous space.
It's like AI and technology. It's really at its embryonic stages.
And we hope for companies like us in the future, right now we are tackling biologics with biosimilars. The next thing would be, the next big thing for us will be taking cell therapy, gene therapy, CAR T therapy, and doing affordable versions of those for patients.
Got it. Rick, you want to come up and see what's on the minds of our audience?
Hello, Ed. Hello, Vanita. So for those of you who recognize that Ed was very facile about the world of pharmaceuticals, he served as a distinguished and long-term member of both the AbbVie and Abbott boards of directors. So, first question is, how do generic producers acquire the formulas by which you replicate the pharmaceuticals that you're manufacturing?
Great, great question. We reverse engineer. Our scientists are programmed to really take a look at the formula and try to figure out the best way to get there, to replicate it without infringing any of the brand patents. So we go around, you know, we reformulate the drug, and we go around patents. And like I was saying earlier, you know, tablet capsule, relatively speaking, easier. But for a biologic or an inhalation drug, like a metered dose inhaler or dry powder inhaler, we will do the chemistry, the development from a chemistry perspective, to prove the drug is the same as the brand. But then we do clinical studies, you know, that get the investment up to $100 million or for a inhaler to $50 million or so. So it's a combination of things that, you know, not only chemistry work, but also clinical work that we do to prove that the drugs are equivalent to the brand.
Is there an approval process once your chemists have reversed the patent information? Is there an approval process by which you get permission to distribute the drugs to consumers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, every drug that we bring to market, every prescription drug, has to be FDA approved.
Do pharmas see you as competitors or collaborators?
Big pharma?
Mm-hmm.
I think they see us more as competitors than collaborators because, you know, they create the market and we come, and bring affordable versions that does not give them, you know, the opportunity to continue to sell their products. So I think there is, but it's a healthy competition. I'd say that we partner a lot with pharma companies as well. In a number of, you know, AbbVie and Abbott, we have authorized generic versions of their products that we promote as a generic company. So we collaborate as well as we compete.
Hey, Rick, could I? I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I want to go back to the reverse engineering.
Yeah.
So there are countries in the world that do not honor patents, that reverse engineer patented products. I will not name those countries, those countries. But how do you prevent that? So how do you prevent the Russians from, or the Chinese or the Brazilians, whatever, from reverse engineering and really injuring the patent protection that's necessary for those drugs? Do you have any view on that?
I think the whole patent prosecution process and the patent challenge process is fairly advanced in the U.S. I mean, so you really cannot find a way for companies to go around, you know, if they have, you know, they've filed a particular product and they go around a different way to do it, that's a GMP issue.
Yes.
Which the FDA regulates that.
Yes.
Yes. And the FDA is very good about regulating it.
Sorry, Rick.
So, and I apologize, there are so many great questions, we won't be able to get, obviously, to all of them. But once you have reversed the formulas, is there an approval process which you have to go through before you introduce the drugs to pharmacies and consumers in the generic industry?
Yes, every product, every prescription drug has to go through an application to the FDA and an approval process before we can bring it to market.
And what's the average life?
So
I
stand corrected. The only time the agency has allowed, and again, it was the agency's discretion to allow. I mean, in the last 12 to 24 months, there have been multiple drug shortage situations. Like, I think it was Abbott with the baby foods, right? That they had a challenge, and the FDA allowed product from Australia to come into the U.S. without approval. Likewise, on one of the smoking cessation drug, the Pfizer drug, I'm forgetting the name, Chantix. Chantix, Pfizer withdrew from the market, and there was no generic version. So again, the FDA allowed Canada to ship the product without approval. And it continues to come in to the U.S. without an FDA approval. So there are, by exception, the agency allows drugs that are in drug shortage, that are in shortage, to be brought to market.
And how long is the average life of a generic?
It all depends, Rick. I mean, it depends on the product. I'll give you a very recent example of an oral solid product. So tablets and capsules have become a very, very competitive space, fiercely competitive, because there are 200 generic companies, and we have three of these vertically integrated buyers, which has created a pretty tough dynamic from a pricing perspective. So just last month, we launched the generic, first generic, for a drug called Latuda, Lurasidone, CNS drug. The brand was $4.2 billion in revenues. Within a couple of weeks, the generic market is $12 million. Same product, same prescriptions, $12 million, $4.2 billion. 99.7% price erosion, not overnight, but within a month.
Wow.
Yeah.
For those of us who've been in business, 99.7% price erosion, how would you feel about that in your own businesses? Amazon recently made the much anticipated announcement that they are going to become pharmaceutical providers. What, if any, impact will that have on generics like Lupin and on branded pharmaceutical manufacturers.
So I see Amazon as another new channel to get products to the patients. They have tried to create their own formulary. They have their distribution for certain. They have very novel ways of getting drugs to patients. They're talking about getting drones to drop drugs to patients. So I think it is, I really wish them a lot of success, and we partner with them. We supply products to Amazon right now. And we'll continue to, we supply drugs also to Mark Cuban and his company. And we'll continue to support those channels.
You've decided to locate your headquarters in Naples. There are great scientific medical centers in Boston, New York, Chicago, San Francisco. Why Naples?
I love it.
Okay.
That's why.
Okay, next question.
No, but seriously. I mean, what I realized when I moved to Naples, because initially everyone asked me, did you retire? And I said, no, I am the CEO. I'm still active. I go to the office every day. I deal with the challenges and opportunities every day. What I found in Florida is all the pharma CEOs are in Florida. You know, so the ability to really network and collaborate has grown tremendously when I moved from the Northeast to Florida. We still have our business in the Northeast. We have our R&D and manufacturing center in New Jersey. We have inhalation R&D center in the East Coast of Florida. And hopefully in the future, we'll have a Boston innovation center. But I asked my team in Baltimore, all my executive team, how many people want to move to Naples? All hands were up.
Yeah, I bet.
So.
We could have guessed that it would have been unanimous about Naples versus Baltimore. Why are so many products manufactured in India, both generic, and are there branded products manufactured in India?
Yes, for certain. So I didn't say much about my company, so I'll maybe add a little bit about Lupin as well.
Sure.
So Lupin has both branded drugs as well as generic products. I mean, roughly 50% of our business is pure generics, and 50% of our business is branded. So in countries like India, in Brazil, in Mexico, in Germany, in South Africa, in Philippines, we are a branded company. And we have our own brands that we bring to physicians, that the physicians prescribe. And in the other countries, we have generics. And there's some countries where we have both brands and generics. So India is right now, are there molecules that have come out of India? There are multiple molecules that were discovered in India that have been taken on for further research by Big Pharma to bring them to market. So, for example, we have two oncology drugs that we discovered. You know, we set up a team to do drug discovery because when my father set up the company, long-term, he wanted Lupin to discover its own molecules, bring its own molecules to market. So we started building capability on innovation and discovering oncology drugs, two of which are licensed to, one is to AbbVie, and the other is to BI. And we hope that they will make it to market. So India certainly has the capability to innovate. You know, it's still evolving from a risk-taking capability of because a novel drug costs billions of dollars, and no Indian company will take that kind of risk today.
Thank you. There were a number of questions about China. One of which is representative, and what will it take to bring antibiotic manufacturing back to the U.S. from China?
You don't want antibiotic manufacturing back in the U.S.
Wow.
I will tell you that. I mean, so we are, when I brought Lupin into the U.S., my launch pad was antibiotics. Lupin, when my father started it, was a tuberculosis company and then became an antibiotics company. And I saw the opportunity for antibiotics in the U.S., and that was our start in the U.S. Today, the antibiotics, just because of the competition, the pricing of antibiotics is really low. Manufacturing in India is probably India is the lowest cost manufacturing place in the world from a pharma manufacturing standpoint. there are drugs, antibiotics, where we make zero margin, you know, at the U.S. pricing manufactured in India. If you manufacture drugs in the U.S., unless the government supports a price increase, there is no way you can sustain it.
So there have been two major drug companies that have reduced dramatically the cost of insulin. So one can look at that, obviously, as positive, and others can say, my goodness, 70-plus percent margins would seem not to be necessary. Is your answer the same, that they use these margins to help advance pharmaceuticals and bring innovations to the market?
Well, for sure.
COVID obviously affected all of us in this room and everyone around the world. What role do you believe that the generics have played in the fight against COVID? And secondly, is there anything promising to impact and reduce the time of long COVID?
Good questions. So the first question was, what role has generics played in a tremendous, a huge role? I mean, when you look at right at the beginning of the pandemic, the need for antibiotics grew. Azithromycin, a drug that we make, grew tremendously. Hydroxychloroquine, you know, that was considered to be efficacious at that point in time. Again, India was the largest manufacturer. Generics were the largest suppliers. And then definitely outside of the U.S., in the low and middle income countries, generic companies got licenses from brand companies like Gilead to make drugs like remdesivir to bring them to market. So, I mean, the requirement of drugs surged big time through COVID, which was both a challenge and an opportunity. On the one hand, you know, when you look at the number of businesses that closed through COVID, for us as pharma manufacturers, we had to figure out how to keep our facilities running, make drugs available at a different pace while keeping our employees safe. So it was a huge challenge, but it was a tremendous opportunity to rise to the challenge.
Last question. You just mentioned that you're continuing to work, and we talked at lunch that the FDA is meeting with your team in just a few weeks. 5 years. It normally, certainly in many of the industries the rest of us have been involved in, that would be an interminably long time. Why do the FDA processes take so long, in addition to trying to avoid risk and to be as safe as possible?
So for the more complex products, you know, and I'd say tablets, capsules are 99% genericized. Instead of the 90%, 10% mix, I'd say tablet capsules are maybe 99% or so genericized because it's easy to do or easier to do. The more complex products, like this one is an inhalation product. It's a dry powder inhaler. And the FDA does not have a guidance for it. So we came up with a path to, you know, we've got a path that we created to, you know, show that the drug is equivalent to the brand. The clinical study, a 500 patient clinical study, in addition to the chemistry, did all of that, went to the agency, and agreed that it was okay to file the product as we had developed it. So all of, you know, and for the agency to review that, they are learning on these complex products as we are going through this process. You know, and that is the case with inhalation products. That's the case with some biologics. That's the case with other implants, IUDs, intrauterine devices, and the like. The FDA is learning, and the industry is learning along with them, and that's why it takes long. But at the end of the day, you know, it enables us to bring affordable versions of those products to market.
Perfect. Thank you, Ed.
See you all in 2 weeks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well done. Well done. Thank you.